Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama meets tomorrow with Senate leaders about a Supreme Court nominee to replace David Souter. The smart money says he'll nominate a woman. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 76, is the only female in a court of 9 justices. The reported shortlist includes women of all types, academics, judges, a governor, gay women, single, married, a Latina. No one's arguing it shouldn't be a woman. But what exactly would a female justice bring to the bench? And is it something different from a male? This hour on Point, women and the Supreme Court. You can join the conversation. What kind of justice do you want to see appointed to the High Court? If it's a woman, what kind of thinker? What kind of woman? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in a few minutes from Stanford Law Professor Deborah Rohde, a preeminent scholar in the field of gender and the law, and a colleague of two potential nominees. Joining me first from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal analyst for Slate, the online magazine. She's been following all the speculation around President Obama's impending nomination to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Souter. Dahlia, great to have you back.
Thank you for having me back.
And with us from Washington is Hannah Rosen, writer for The Atlantic and a contributor to Slate. She and Dahlia recently co-wrote a piece about potential female nominees to the court and their backgrounds. She's a founder of a new web magazine launching today called XX.com. It's a site focused on women and supported by Slate. Hannah Rosen, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right. This is deep and wonderful and maybe treacherous waters, and you have both written so well on it. It's really great to have you with us, and here we are. I mean, all this is imminent. Dahlia, I always put a lot of stock in your observation of what's going on here, but you say there's sort of two big basic questions here. First, what do we mean when we say we need more female justices? And second, if we accept there's such a thing as female jurisprudence, and there's a whole big debate about that, how do we then evaluate candidates for this position of female Supreme Court justice? Go to the first, Dahlia. What do we mean when we say we need more female justices? Just to have a woman in the group photo?
Well, I think that's a part of it, Tom, but I think it's an increasingly small part of it. I mean, without doubt, I think we should take Ruth Bader Ginsburg at her word when she says, and she has said it over and over again over the last couple of years, this just isn't working. She has gone out of her way. And this is, I just want to be very clear, this is a Supreme Court justice who has not gone out of her way to complain her way through her judicial career. She's been very, very quiet about gender issues and has confined it to her written opinions. But of late, she's been very vocal, saying not just that she's lonely, but more explicitly that some of the men on the court don't share her sensibilities and her sensitivities, and that the court is just not getting it on these basic issues, from the Lilly Ledbetter fair pay case a couple of years ago to a very, very recent strip search case in which a 13-year-old girl was strip searched. And the court was almost talking about it as though it was some kind of Sigma Nu prank. What's so bad about being strip searched? We
Big
get changed
deal.
In the locker all the time. Mm-hmm. She was, I think, even on the bench, quite irritated. And I think more and more, she just has a sense that they don't understand that in some cases, not all cases, women are different.
They don't understand. Hannah Rosen, is this a culture war issue that's kind of your specialty, or is this just getting the right balance of Americans reflected on the court? There's many things we could look for there. There's no Latina, there's no Asian, there's no open gay.
It's true. There are two things that complicate this. One is that, in fact, women are not as rare as they were, say, in 1981 when Ronald Reagan wanted to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court and had to look for Sandra Day O'Connor, and she was just a state judge at the time, and everybody called her an obscure state judge. I mean, the landscape has changed a lot in the legal profession. Which
absolutely.
I'm sure Dahlia knows well, and you know that there is a lot more women to choose from, so it's not that difficult. The second thing that complicates this, and this gets into what is it exactly that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is looking for, and this is a piece that story that Dahlia wrote in Slate this morning, which I thought really got to the heart of this issue, which is the focus on the word empathy.
Mm.
So when President Obama transmitted that he wanted someone with empathy, somebody that he wasn't just going to look at somebody's resume, everybody, and particularly the right, speculated hard. Empathy has become our sort of new euphemism. It's become a code word right now that everybody's arguing over. What does empathy mean? Does that have to be a woman? Well, Dahlia wrote that she doesn't think that empathy has to be, that he wasn't transmitting that he was looking for a woman, even though that's what many people understood. Would Ruth Bader Ginsburg be just as happy with a man who is extremely empathetic for one reason or another? Mm. Is that what she's trying to transmit? So that's the sort of extra complication in do we need a woman or do we not? Is it just somebody who's more empathetic who we're looking for?
Dolly, what about that? I mean, Obama has said empathy, heart and empathy, and he hasn't just said it once. He's said it a lot. You write that there's been pushback from the right on that. RNC Chairman Michael Steele last Friday on a radio show said, crazy nonsense empathetic. I'll give you empathy. Empathize right on your behind. To which your little rejoinder is, nice. but even it's not just from the left. I mean, from the right, you could be on the left and empathy could sound like code for old fashioned sort of, you know, bacon cookies, mommy tenderness.
Well, and I think that's a mistake. I think if you read The Audacity of Hope, Obama has actually been talking about empathy. This mm-hmm. didn't spring up 2 weeks ago. He talked about it on the campaign trail. When Hannah's quite right, every time he's been asked about the qualities he's looking for in a jurist, that word comes up. So it wasn't a slip. In The Audacity of Hope, he's very clear what he means by empathy. He doesn't mean sobbing desperately from the bench as the defendants tell their sad stories. He doesn't even mean, and I think this is where the GOP gets it wrong, that you favor the poor or the downtrodden over others. That's not empathy. That's bias. What he says in The Audacity of Hope is empathy is the simple quality of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, thinking through how other people are affected by your decisions. That's not a complicated notion, but I think it's been loaded up and larded up in the conversation with every single quality that we think makes you a bad jurist. And so when conservatives talk about what Obama really is telegraphing when he says empathy, they start saying judicial activism, you know, substituting your ideology for the democratically elected, you know, will of the people. I mean, it's just weird. It maps perfectly onto all their criticisms of activist judges. But I think the most important thing, and Hannah just got to this and it's so important, empathy to Obama, I think, simply means what are the real world consequences on the ground, out in the world of your decisions? This is not a mechanistic process of applying facts to law. If it were, we could have a supercomputer in the Supreme Court. We wouldn't need nine of them. We only would need one. But judging affects people. And I think one of the complaints about the Supreme Court, time and again in the last couple of years, is that you can't make a Lilly Ledbetter type fair pay decision or strip search decision or any number of decisions where you say, sorry, my hands are tied, the law is the law, I don't care how it affects this plaintiff, without ultimately, I think, getting the reputation of being a very cold mechanistic court.
So you're saying empathetic justice does not equal female justice, and yet the goal of another female justice to make Ruth Bader Ginsburg less lonely and presumably a lot more is still out there. You've written about it, Dahlia. You said, you know, what are we looking for here? The court operates at many levels. Are we just looking for social legitimacy by having that 50% of the population represented, or is there a feminine jurisprudence? It's Susanna Sherry's phrase from some years ago now, a controversial one. But what about it? Is it just legitimacy or is it something in particular about feminine jurisprudence, Dahlia?
Now, there is some, you know, this has been studied. So what difference does it make to have a female on the court? I think there was an op-ed written in the New York Times recently about this. Mm. I'm sure Deborah Rhodes will speak to it later in the hour, is that it does actually make a difference, but not as vast a difference as one would think. The study says that women, there is a difference in sex discrimination cases, that the presence of women on a panel does make a difference. difference there, that they do tend to vote in favor they do tend to uphold sex discrimination. And the second thing that it shows is that it makes a difference if women are on a panel with men, that the men tend to be more sympathetic if the women are on the panel with them.
Let's get a call right here from Saginaw, Michigan. Helen's calling in with a question for Dahlia and Hannah. Helen, you're on the air.
It's mostly a comment, Tom.
Yes, please.
It's a lovely day in Saginaw, Michigan. Hello.
Beautiful.
I couldn't help but feel that this discussion would not have occurred if it were a man being considered. It's still a point where a woman has to be different, has to prove herself. I'm 87 years old. I've lived through all of this.
Yep.
I can't believe that it matters so much if we're considering a woman. You would have a show on the qualities of whatever man was being considered. You wouldn't have a show based on what will a man bring to the court.
Helen, I'm glad you raised that, because I came into this with a lot of trepidation on exactly that point, and yet there's a lot of conversation about it out there right now. And Dahlia, you've been writing about it very prominently. I mean, Helen's saying, why are we even talking about this?
Well, I think Helen's absolutely right. We shouldn't be talking about it, but we happen to be in a nation, and it's in stark contrast to, for instance, the Canadian Supreme Court, where half the justices are women and the chief justice is a woman. We happen to be in a nation where there's one woman out of nine on the U.S. Supreme Court, and so that just looks extraordinary. And I think that there are a lot of women who were very, very disappointed by the failure of Hillary Clinton to clinch the nomination, who really feel that that represents a structural imbalance in this country, that a woman can't get a fair shake. And some of that conversation is bleeding into this conversation. So I don't think we want to look at this conversation about the Supreme Court completely in a vacuum. I think we need to understand it in the context of there are a lot of women in the United States who are still deeply, deeply angry about what happened to Hillary Clinton, and that's informing this discussion.
One of nine. Hannah, we just got a few seconds before the break, but I mean, should this be a gender-blind discussion? Should it all be about Roe v. Wade and all the rest without any regard to the gender?
You know, you're asking someone who just participated in founding a women's magazine.
Yeah.
We had the same discussion as you had about your show. Do we really need a women's magazine? Isn't a women's magazine a sort of defunct thing?
Right.
But then you realize, no, there's a lot of issues that need to be worked out still.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women and the Supreme Court as President Obama chooses a nominee to succeed David Souter, asking, is there such a thing as female jurisprudence, and what kind of woman might make it to the court this time? Hannah Rosen and Dahlia Lithwick have joined us. Dahlia, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate Magazine. Hannah, contributing writer for The Atlantic. She's founding editor of the new website, launching today, XXX.com. Good luck with that, Hannah. Joining us right now from Palo Alto, California, is Deborah Rohde, professor at Stanford Law School, one of the nation's leading experts on gender issues and the law. She's director of Stanford's The Law School Center on the Legal Profession. And she's a colleague of two women, Kathleen Sullivan and Pamela Carlin, who are considered to be potential nominees by President Obama to the Supreme Court. She clerked herself for Justice Thurgood Marshall, author of 20 books, including Women and Leadership, The State of Play, and Strategies for Change. She's former chair of the American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession. Deborah Rohde, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Does it matter if, I mean, in one sense, it's incredibly obvious and it's crying out to be done. But at the level of jurisprudence and outcomes, does it matter if we have women on the bench?
Well, I think it matters greatly, but not simply because we want to change the group photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that has that we've learned since watching Clarence Thomas occupy the so-called black seat in the aftermath of Justice Thurgood Marshall's retirement is it matters enormously what kind of black or what kind of woman. There's not a single woman's point of view, and putting more women in positions of power doesn't necessarily empower more women. It depends who and with what level of concern, commitment, and empathy they bring to the job. And so we can't solely be driven by demographics. But it does, for all the reasons Dahlia suggests, matter enormously, not just for the legitimacy of the court to have it fairly reflect the public that's subject to its authority, but also because people's backgrounds do inform how they perceive certain cases, and equally important, as the research shows, how they broaden the perspective of their male colleagues.
You've been looking at this for a long time. How does that work when there's a woman or women on a bench, whether that's the U.S. Supreme Court or further down the line? Are there conclusions that can be drawn about how that court then operates?
Well, yes, but I don't want to be too narrowly outcome oriented on it.
Mm-hmm.
The studies actually are quite mixed, and the one that was referenced earlier in the show, which showed some sex some differences in results in gender discrimination, sex harassment cases, has not been replicated in some other studies. So the research is mixed, and much of it depends on how much you control for. I think one thing that you can say is that gender is not as important as ideology in terms of predicting outcomes. But it does seem to play a role, and especially according to at least a good number of studies, in cases where that's a relevant issue. And Justice Ginsburg herself has made the point. She notes that, you know, she votes much more often with the liberal wing of the court than she did with Justice O'Connor. But they did seem to stay together in the sex discrimination cases that came before the court. Now, if Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg had been different kinds of appointments, you wouldn't necessarily see, when you only have two of them, that there's a, quote, female voice emerging from the bench. So I think you have to look at the whole person. But there's no question but that people's backgrounds and experiences with discrimination are much more likely to give them that quality that's been, I too think, inappropriately maligned from the right, of being able to see the world from someone else's perspective, and even more important, to understand the real world consequences of their legal decision.
Dahlia, you've written reminding us that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has been one of the most vocal detractors of this notion of women bringing a different voice to judging, quoting her saying there is simply no empirical evidence that gender differences lead to discernible differences in rendering judgment.
That's true, but let's remember that initial Susanna Sherry study that you referenced that tried to point out that women are, quote, relational, you know, that they put relationships first and they put feelings first, and that men are more rule-based and women care more about feelings. That study was about her, and so I can certainly see why anyone with any kind of operating brain wouldn't want to be the victim of a study that says you're a big mushy pile of emotional goo while all the men on the court are serious, rigorous thinkers. So, of course, I think she's distanced herself from that as an intellectual frame. But she went out of her way to say that she thought she should have been replaced by a woman when Bush was looking for nominees.
Let's go to some of our callers. A lot want to join this conversation. Gail in Westford, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Gail.
Hi, Tom. This is a very exciting topic for me, and I'm so happy to be able to just say something very briefly. There is no question, and this is my religion, that it is the reasons that we have the problems in the world is because 50% of these major decisions should be made by women. They really should be. And it's if we peel off each layer, we will see, and it would be so profound and it would run so deep that does have to happen. And it would really benefit men. And I hope that they understand that at some point. I read a book that was called Misogyny. It was written by a journalist. He wrote fabulous stories all over the world about everything. His final book was Misogyny, and he was dying of cancer, but it was the one book he absolutely felt needed to be written of all the books and all the writing he did in his life.
So bravo, bring on a female justice, you say, Gail, and that would just be two of nine, not up to your 50%, but we've got it, and I think if we were calling, we get one more from Detroit, Michigan. Jason, you're on the air.
Hey there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have just two real quick points to make. In light of the disgusting behavior by the justices in the case about the young girl that was strip searched, Mm-hmm. We need more empathy, but we don't just need more empathy on the court. We need more decency, and we need more courtesy, and we need more respect for people. My second point, having to do with having another woman on the Supreme Court, I'm very much in favor of that. I think we need more women on the Supreme Court in general. But there was, a question asked at the beginning, sort of the intro to the show was, should it be an openly gay woman? Should it be, some other sort of minority? That doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is if she's competent and she's qualified to do the job. Those are the two most important things to me. If she's got a strong legal background and she knows what she's doing, I don't care who she is. And I'll just take my responses off the air. Thanks.
Jason, thank you very much for your call. Competent and qualified. Hannah Rosen, you and Dahlia have written recently, and kind of controversially, to this question that Deborah Rohde raises of what kind of women. You wrote that the list of potential, that there's a lot of potential nominees here. As Deborah says, the ranks of women in the legal profession has absolutely exploded, and President Obama is very overtly looking beyond that, and maybe a governor, maybe Janet Napolitano, but you wrote that the list of potential replacements is overpopulated by women who are single, childless, or divorced. And then you quote Josh Gersten at the Politico reporting that two of the top candidates are gay. You're sort of putting this stuff out there, and I'm trying to interpret why. Is this related to the what kind of woman question that Deborah Rohde raises? I don't know. What's your point in getting into that?
This is more related to political language and kind of how it spreads and develops, and the idea that as soon as you had these short lists put out, we were looking at kind of the underground conversation that was happening about them, and we realized pretty quickly that people didn't have any language to talk about this kind of woman. It was clear from the list that there were a large, more than is true in the population, large number of women who were in their 50s, single and childless. And so we were looking at sort of the rumors and the things that got started around there, and realized that there really was no language for this sort of American bachelorette, just as there is no language for the American bachelor when David Souter was nominated.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the euphemisms have continued even when Politico reported that and Pamela Carlin wrote an email back saying, yes, I count myself in the LGBT community, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. Even then, the discussion did not sort of come on the table. Well, what would it mean to have an openly gay Supreme Court nominee, which is an extremely interesting question and one that hasn't been hashed out the way maybe the gender question has been. And yet, came more euphemisms like Jeff Sessions, who replaced Arlen Specter on the Judiciary Committee, talked about how he felt having someone with homosexual tendencies.
Gay tendencies, he said.
Yeah, homosexual tendencies per se. Now, that was another thing to parse, because, in fact, now on the right, that's kind of the enlightened position, is that you can accept someone with homosexual tendencies as long as they don't act on those homosexual tendencies. So, in fact, everybody was in their language confirming this notion of people being in the closet. Yes, we prefer someone who maybe is and maybe isn't, and that seems like our ideal candidate.
Deborah Rohde, Pamela Carlin at Stanford. Stanford is a colleague of yours, as is Kathleen Sullivan. You said what kind of woman will be more important than just the sort of checking the gender box itself. What do you mean by that? Are you getting into this whole single, childless, divorced, married, gay, straight issue? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, let me separate out the sexual orientation issue from the childless, is this someone who will devote themselves 24/7 to the court?
Mm.
I think there's no serious question but that all of the women who have made the short list and would be likely to make the short list, children or not, are ones who have shown that level of devotion and capacity to their career. So I think the family life issue ought to be off the table.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think from a broader cultural standpoint, Dahlia and Hannah are absolutely right to raise the point, and we know demographically that women in the legal profession in general are more likely to be childless than their male counterparts, and women who reach the top at the leadership level much more likely. And so, having children in today's world still turns out to be a career asset for men and a career hurdle for women. On the point about sexual orientation, I've been asked this by others, commentators, who say, well, would this be a historic plus for the president, the first to have this first? appointment or a political liability that's not yet affordable. Mm. And, you know, in the world I'd like to inhabit, sexual orientation would be irrelevant to an appointment for judicial office. But in the imperfect world we now inhabit, I'd like to think that it's an asset, because the only way to get from here to there is for the nation to experience superbly qualified judges who are out. And, you know, that's not to ignore the political risks that are going to accompany the first nomination to the Supreme Court, but Thurgood Marshall was not an uncontroversial appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a confirmation battle is worth fighting. So I do truly think that we're not going to get to the world in which we want to live if this is a disqualifying candidate for someone who is otherwise would be a superb appointment to the Supreme Court.
So let's put it out there, maybe, and just talk about it. Dahlia Lithwick, how about it? I mean, you say, you know, is it going to take, what, a gay president to have a gay Supreme Court justice? Deborah Rohde says it's what kind of woman we put on the court that matters. How do you hear that question, that issue? Is that why you're digging into single, childless, gay, straight, and so on?
Well, for one thing, I couldn't agree more. I think Professor Rohde just put it perfectly right there. It shouldn't be an issue. But I think the notion that it might be a disqualifying factor without ever talking about it, that to me is abhorrent. So I think, you know, I want to live in a world where we're never having this conversation, in addition to never having the conversation about whether there should be a woman in the court. But like Professor Rohde, I think that if this is a disqualifying factor, or if, as Hannah says, we're talking about it in this really subversive coded language, you know, where I heard a conservative commentator say last week that the reason Kathleen Sullivan, otherwise brilliant, supremely qualified candidate, shouldn't be on the Supreme Court is simply because the issue of gay marriage might come before the court. If that's how we're going to talk about it, I think that's very damaging. Nobody thinks that African Americans can't decide race cases.
Right.
Nobody thinks that women can't decide gender cases. So I think that one of the things all that Hannah and I really were asking for by putting this issue out there, A, making the economic point that Professor Rohde flags, which is, of course these women are going to be overdetermined to be 50 years old, single, childless, and
sure,
then people are going to speculate, but also making, I think, the deeper point that is, we need to find the language to talk about this.
Here's how Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, who's now the ranking Republican member of the Judiciary Committee after Arlen Specter's split, talked about it when he was asked on MSNBC's Morning Joe last week if he would let a Supreme Court nominee's sexual orientation affect his selection process.
You know, it depends on their personal ethics and standards and their legal skill and ability. I don't think a person who acknowledges that they have gay tendencies is disqualified per se for the job. We'll just have to see.
Is this going to be an issue, Hannah Rosen? Is this what we're going to be hearing about at confirmation
gay
proceedings?
Gay tendencies just kills me every time. It's like gay tendencies.
I tend.
It's sort of, you know, you add that word tendencies. And
yeah, no, that's a, doesn't it evoke little Boy Scouts
right.
Choir boys? Oh, my God.
And I mean, you just hear that word. It's like, you know, all he wants everyone to hear is, I don't think that anyone who's gay should be disqualified, right? But that really is not what he said. He said someone with gay tendencies. And as I said, that means something very specific, particularly to the conservative Christian community and to Catholics. Gay tendencies means to them that you are in the closet. It means that that's a sort of enlightened acknowledgement that you were born gay, that people can be born gay, which is a position that the last pope kind of finally acknowledged. It was possible that there was a genetic tendency to be gay, but you still cannot act on that tendency. So basically, we're asking for suppression. I mean, that's crazy. We all know that that doesn't work. So it's not, you know, it's not as open-hearted as it seems, let's say.
Dahlia, you spend a lot of time in Washington. Is this going to be an issue, or are we going to step right past it?
I suspect we're going to step right past it, which I think is unfortunate. I think that there's just, as Hannah said at the very beginning, the bench to pull from is so deep and so talented that I think Obama can pick a truly first-rate candidate without even getting to the second thorny question. And as both of the other guests have said, I think that's unfortunate because this is a thorny question that it's long overdue that we need to figure out how to get to it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about women and the Supreme Court as President Obama chooses a nominee to succeed Justice David Souter, retiring this summer, asking, is there such a thing as female jurisprudence, and what kind of woman might make it to the court this time? We're joined from Palo Alto, California, by Deborah Rohde, professor at Stanford Law School, one of the nation's leading experts on gender issues and the law. Dahlia Lithwick is with us from Slate. Hannah Rosen is with us from The Atlantic and her new website, XXX.com. Here's just a little bit of Stanford Law professor, colleague of Deborah Rohde, Pamela Carlin. This is in 2007. She's speaking about the Supreme Court's new then view on abortion following a 5-4 ruling upholding a ban on late-term abortion. Justice Ginsburg, the only woman left on the court, had said the result was alarming. Here's Pamela Carlin.
Obviously, the result is different because Justice O'Connor was replaced by Justice Alito. But the tone of this opinion is really quite extraordinary because it has shifted from being an argument about abortion regulations being designed to further the state's interest in human life alone into a case in which the argument is that the reason, and I'm going to probably regret this in a moment that I say this, but that women will later regret their decisions. And so in order to protect them, we have to save them.
Pamela Carlin, 2007, she's on the short list for the Supreme Court right now. Deborah Rohde, give us a little analysis of that. Why is she saying, I'm probably going to regret saying this?
Well, I think...
That she's describing the court as kind of paternalistically stepping in over women there?
Well, I think she is joining the mainstream of commentators on from across the political spectrum in describing that particular passage from Justice Kennedy's decision. And it's one that many women, including those who embrace the I'm not a feminist but label, find offensive. I mean, this is a country in which a third of women have had abortions, and to claim that they all don't know their own minds, and we have to protect them not by giving them more information about the procedure, but by banning it. I think she was making a point about the lack, I would, for as want of any other word, say empathy would work pretty well here, of genuine empathy for what the experience of having an abortion is like, to write that sentence in as unqualified a way as Justice Kennedy did. And, maybe as she uttered it, she realized, boy, this could get me into trouble in confirmation hearings down the pike, because clearly the partial birth abortion issue was one that carried very strong emotional resonance, and a majority of the country opposed the procedure, not just a majority of Congress and the court. So, it's not the most politically expedient issue on which to speak. But I think one of the great qualities of Pam is her real courage. She lives by her principles, and she doesn't trim her sails just to make her record look a little bit less controversial.
Dahlia, take us on into this short list of potential nominees, if you would. Lots of women here. Professor Carlin right there, and not alone at Stanford. Professor Sullivan there as well. But then we've got everything from academics, Diane Wood in Chicago, and others, to judges, Sotomayor, to, people are talking about Jennifer Granholm, governor of Michigan, talking about Jen Napolitano, now head of Homeland Security, former governor of Arizona. Give us a sense of the sort of terrain of this deep bench, Dahlia.
Well, I think you've essentially laid out the three classes. One is these academics, and I want to echo what Professor Rohde just said. Pam Carlin and Kathleen Sullivan from Stanford are not only two of the smartest women I've ever encountered. They're just two of the smartest people I've ever encountered. They're both exceptionally brilliant constitutional thinkers. To that, we add the other sort of academic who is now the Solicitor General, Elena Kagan. Now, she's just been confirmed as Solicitor General. She'd be the first woman Solicitor General. And she and the two Stanford professors kind of are the academic block. Then there's this block of judges who are appeals court judges, and this is the traditional place that Supreme Court justices have been selected from in the last few decades. So you have Diane Wood, an appeals court judge from Chicago. You have Sonia Sotomayor from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. She's got the sort of double plus of being not just a woman and a very, very talented woman jurist, but also she's a Puerto Rican, so she would be presumably the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice. And then you have, like you say, these political figures. And Obama, I think, has signaled in certain ways over the years that that's interesting to him, to have a Janet Napolitano, to have a Jennifer Granholm, somebody who he likens to Earl Warren. He says that was a really smart pick because having a politician on the court mixes it up a little bit and undermines the sense that they're all pointy-headed liberals who – I'm sorry, pointy-headed jurists who live in a sort of monastic bubble. So he's suggested at different times that that would be interesting to him, and that's what makes Napolitano and Granholm such interesting candidates.
Hannah Rosen, how do you look at this issue of political figures maybe pulled in here? It's been done many times, but right now there are not a lot of those on the court. When you think about qualifications, and we mean those in terms of jurisprudence, but also we're talking in wider cultural terms here, and maybe Obama's thinking that way as well. Do those political figures look equally qualified? I mean, Jennifer Granholm went to Harvard Law School. She's got a legal background. But how do you look at that category in terms of qualification, Hannah, from your perspective?
Well, in terms of the issues we talked about earlier, I think it just magnifies the sort of debate, and particularly the culture war debate, about what somebody's personal experience would bring to bear in terms of their jurisprudence. In this case, not sort of who and what they are personally, but, you know, they have long records on policies involving abortion and all the issues that the court brought up, and they can't so easily say, well, I was on a panel of judges, or sort of hide behind legal principle. In this case, they may have said something in a campaign, or they may have, you know, pushed something, pushed a piece of legislation, and so I think it does make the confirmation process maybe more interesting, but also more tricky.
Let's get a call here from Westwood, Massachusetts, and Molly. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I listen to you all the time. I could make comments on all about everything that these ladies have said,
yeah.
But I think a woman is to have a woman on the Supreme Court is my primary concern. And the second thing is she should not be a strict constructionist. Our Constitution is devised to be elastic. It should not be a confining prison of literal interpretation. That's my comment.
We got it loud and clear, Molly. Deborah Rohde, what about it? Many have said President Obama may be looking for someone to articulate a liberal view of the world on the court. In that role, who do you see perhaps strong on his short list, if that's what he's looking for?
Well, you know, I think he has a lot of very good choices. I think Dahlia is absolutely right. And, you know, two are my colleagues, Pam Carlin and Kathleen Sullivan, who both are in extremely deep and principled thinkers with an enormous following among constitutional law experts and scholars. I also think that it's quite possible that he'll look extra hard for a woman of color and one whose background brings a diversity of experience to the position. And I think those are important qualifications as well.
Dahlia, you've written on this front about, and again, this gets into, it's controversial in feminist circles, but both sides are here, this notion of a more relational approach to the law. Molly says, please, not a strict constructionist. There's this idea of maybe Justice Antonin Scalia representing, you know, a real commitment to unchanging rules, crisp legal principles. Fundamentally, you write, Dahlia, a guy thing. Is there an expectation of something softer, more relational, again, your words and their approach to the law from a female justice? And what does that mean in legal terms, not just, you know, emotional or dynamic?
Well, I think as Professor Rohde pointed out at the outset, the studies on that are so equivocal, whether there is in fact a female jurisprudence that's different from a male jurisprudence. But I do think you get to the heart of it, which is that some of the qualities that we say we're looking for when we talk about empathy are qualities that make you think immediately of a woman. So whether you think that women just their brains are wired differently, or whether you simply think that women might be able to bring a completely different perspective to the court, I think those are two slightly different questions. So I don't actually believe that women's brains are wired differently and that they tend to be more relational or put others first. I think that's a theory that's probably best left in the early 70s. Mm. But I do think that there's something to be said for having more women on the court simply because they can tell their stories, because they have the ability to say, you have no idea what it's like to be a victim of pay discrimination, just to bring up the Lilly Ledbetter case. Mm-hmm. When you're discriminated against, it doesn't come in an envelope announcing that you're the victim of pay discrimination. And so the entire Ledbetter decision, as authored by Justice Sam Alito and Justice O'Connor pointed this out in dissent, reflects no reality that women could ever understand. And so I think that's where the woman's voice becomes important, not because she's different, but because she's able to say, wait, here's what it's like when you're a 13-year-old girl and you're strip searched. It's really different.
She can, in a way, testify or bring witness from that perspective. Let's get a call from Virginia, Waynesboro, Virginia, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air. Hello, Jim, are you there?
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm happy to have a chance to weigh in on this. I'm a Virginia lawyer.
Good.
And I would just like to offer these comments. I've been listening carefully to this. This is a very important issue to all of us. Probably not as important as the election of Obama, but I think this is his first election and is a critically important time in the U.S. in shaping our future. What I think is important is that we see an open-minded thinker appointed to the bench, someone who is certainly sensitive to all of these issues that are being discussed. Not so important to me is whether or not, let me just say this, it's also almost too plain for words that gender does make a difference, and certainly we bring to the table all of our experience through whatever means, whether it's biological or experiential, what we have to offer in life, whether it's on the Supreme Court or in the factory. So it certainly makes a difference, that not to say that we would not see even men come onto the bench who are very sympathetic or empathetic to issues from the opposite gender.
Jim, let me ask you, this time out, Virginia Attorney Jim, would you begin looking for a woman to get that open-minded thinker, or would you look for the open-minded thinker first and let the chips fall where they may on gender?
Oh, gosh, but that's a really very – that's a good question. I would start looking for an open-minded thinker. You know what I would really hope to find, and I say this from the point of view of having watched the PBS special, especially the final edition of American Experience last night, that ended with the events surrounding and leading up to Wounded Knee
on the Native American history. Yes.
Oh my goodness, I would. Which is a topic for a whole nother day or two on your program, but
you want a Native American justice, Jim?
Exactly. That is the kind of empathy, the kind of experience that we need. If there is such a person, if there is such a Native American with the legal talent and the legal experience to appoint to the bench, that is the kind of sensitivity that I would like to see brought to bear on the issues that are the very important social issues that are being brought before the court.
A seat on the bench for every strand. Jim, I appreciate your call. Let me get one right here from, thanks very much, Jim. Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What do you think, Carl? Our time is short.
I look at it like this. We are a young country, but for over two centuries, our Constitution has been interpreted through the eyes of old white men. With that said, the next justice should be competent and able enough to do the job. It should be a woman. It should be a quote-unquote minority. It also should be a younger person And also, I think that his next couple appointments should be women as well.
Memo to President Obama right there. Carl, thank you very much. And one last call, Michael in Savannah, Georgia. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just interested in listening to what the Virginia lawyer said. I was thinking, I've been before a few judges myself, unfortunately, at times, and I think, if I remember correctly, the women were always the toughest. But the reason I called is I'm real excited about Kathleen Sullivan's name being put up there. For one, she's young. She's not already a judge. And the fact that she's gay really makes the court look like something that I would feel comfortable with, being gay myself. I really would love to be able to look at the Supreme Court and relate to it for a change.
Michael, thanks for your call. Dahlia, give us your kind of reading on the wind there. Do you think President Obama will have the, I don't know what the right word is, courage, or will his political instincts take him not perhaps just to a woman, maybe to a minority as well, but to a gay nominee this time?
Yeah. Again, Tom, I think that Obama has gotten to where he is because he's a pragmatist, he's a centrist, he is a listener. I think at least this time around, he's not going to pick a liberal bomb thrower. I think a lot of progressives deeply, deeply wish for someone to be on the court who can articulate, as you said, this opposing view, who can go toe-to-toe with an Antonin Scalia or a John Roberts. I don't think he's going to pick that person. I think he's going to pick someone who's a moderate, who's a centrist, who's a minimalist, and maybe save his powder for the next time.
Well, we will soon enough know, and we'll be back on all the issues of a particular nominee, no doubt, next time around. But this has been a great tour of kind of unique horizon this time, and we're very grateful to each of you for being with us to do it. Professor Deborah Rohde at Stanford Law School, thank you so much for your insights, and thank you for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you.
Dahlia Lithwick with Slate Magazine, always great to have you. Thank you, Dahlia, for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Hannah Rosen, good luck with your new website, XX.com, on women's issues, launched there by Slate. Thank you for joining us, Hannah.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for all your comments today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.